As computers get smarter and more sophisticated by the year, it's a good time to take stock of what makes people different than computers. What makes us human? Our guest this hour went on a quest to answer that question and took part in the Turing test, a kind of computer-human speed dating session, where computers and people compete to see if judges can tell which is the most human in a blind chat. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard, in for Kathleen Dunn, and I'm glad to be with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Brian Christian. He is the author of The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. He also holds a degree in poetry, philosophy, and computer science. And we'd like to hear from you this morning. What do you think sets humans apart from computer programs? Is it our emotions, the way we synthesize ideas, the way we think? Can computers ever become human? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. And Brian Christian, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
What is it that first intrigued you about the Turing test?
Well, I really got interested in the Turing test by reading an article that was in Wired magazine about one of the earliest contestants, if you will, in the Turing test. So the idea of the Turing test goes back to the 1950s. It's this idea from the British mathematician Alan Turing that, you know, we'd get to a point with the computer where we'd want to know if these machines could actually think in a human sense of the word. And Turing's idea was basically to put philosophy and theorizing aside and say, you know, I want to just propose a practical test. And so the idea behind the test is that you get a panel of scientists together, and they're having these short 5-minute-long chat conversations. But what they don't know is whether the person that they're chatting with on the other end, you know, sending these text messages back and forth, is a real person who's kind of hidden in a room down the hall, or a computer program pretending to be a real person. And in Turing's time in the 50s, this was purely hypothetical. But what I found so striking reading about this in Wired was that we've now reached a point, starting from the early 90s and into the 21st century, where these are actually practical questions. And in fact, we're actually holding Turing tests every year.
And sometimes the results are more interesting than others. For instance, the year before you participated, it looked like the computers were on a winning streak.
Well, that's right. There was a sense that, you know, it had been a bit of a close shave, if you will, for humankind. Turing's famous prediction in 1950 was that we'd reach a point, he said by the year 2000, where these computer programs would be fooling us about 30% of the time. About 30% of the time, the judges could not tell which of their conversations was with a human and which was with a computer. And that as a result, we'd come to think of these machines as intelligent. And I'm somewhat relieved to tell you that we have not crossed that threshold. but there have, in fact, been some close shaves. And in fact, the year that my ears really perked up was 2008, where the top computer program at the annual test managed to fool 3 out of the 12 judges, or 25%, meaning that it was just one vote shy of Turing's famous threshold.
Do you think that says something more about the judge than it does about the computer?
Well, that to me is one of the fascinating things about the Turing test, in that it really cuts both ways. You know, what Turing originally imagined as a benchmark for technology is also really a benchmark for how humans communicate, you know, because we are the other half of the test. And the Oxford philosopher John Lucas has said, you know, if computers pass the Turing test, it will not be because their technology is so impressive. It will be because we have become so wooden. And so that for me was part of what really sort of intrigued me and hooked me on the test, was that, you know, it's simultaneously a way to look at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, But it's also, in a little bit of a counterintuitive way, a lens into how humans communicate. And I think, you know, that is part of what I think is so exciting and a little bit scary about living in a time that we do, where this AI software is starting to come into its own. That the existence, for example, of email spam, you know, we're increasingly familiar with getting an email that claims to be from someone we know, but in fact is from an AI program that's sort of impersonating that person.
Well, just how good is this AI programming right now? I mean, you do tell a story in your book about a scientist who decides to go on a Russian dating site and has this deepening relationship with this woman named Ivana, and then things are not what they seem to be.
Right. I mean, I think this is a great cautionary tale, if you will. This is Robert Epstein, who is, in fact, one of the founders of the modern annual Turing test. So if you think, you know, you'd think if anyone was immune to, you know, computer wiles, it would be the guy who founded the test, but not so, as it turned out. Yeah, he had subscribed to a dating service and had been exchanging lengthy emails for over 4 months, as it turned out, with what he thought was a woman in Russia, but in fact was just a computer program.
How could he get through months without thinking something was not quite right? I mean, I guess you would think that the computer was struggling with the language or something?
Well, you know, that's part of it. And in fact, there have been programmers that have competed in the Turing test that tried to, you know, use a little bit of deliberate subfluency as a way to kind of cover over some of their program's mistakes. But I think, you know, part of the deeper point, I think, for me, is this question of what must a relationship, you know, an online relationship be if the computer can go that long sort of faking it? Hmm. And I think part of it speaks to the fact that, you know, so many of the interactions in human life are, in fact, very patterned and very kind of ritualized. You know, so in this particular example, Epstein would write a letter talking about his job, and then, you know, Ivana, quote-unquote, would respond with a letter describing her family and saying that she hoped she would meet him sometime. And you can start to see how this sort of pen-palmanship could actually go quite a ways, because, you know, each person is just sort of taking their turn, rather than really interacting or sort of, you know, prompting the person to talk about specific things. You just sort of let them talk. And so, you know, I think the Turing test is very illuminating of the ways in which, you know, certain conversational styles, as it turns out, are surprisingly easy to mimic compared to others.
So that's what you got to do. You got a chance to analyze what actually makes a fully human conversation. What did you come up with?
That's right. So, of course, these questions, these theoretical questions, became very pressing and practical ones for me, because after the close call that I had witnessed in the 2008 contest, I decided to personally get involved on behalf of humanity, if you will, in the 2009 contest and actually enter it as one of what are called human confederates, which are the real humans that the judges are talking to. So in 2009, I was in this curious position of knowing that in several months I would be on the receiving end of a Turing test. And so all of these questions about, you know, how to act human or how to persuade someone that I'm a human being became very real questions. And so part of the story that the book tells is the story of my attempt to essentially train for my role as a human confederate.
Which you wouldn't think you need training on how to be human. If anything should come naturally, it should be that. But it turns out there is a real art to kind of fully engaging with your humanity. And one of these, I guess, is, as you talked about, is context. What about things like emotional nuance?
Yeah. You know, I think that one of the things that we've tended to maybe oversimplify about human conversation is that we think about it in terms of, you know, information, basically. And even if you look at the way that characters interact in movies or television shows, they often bond by sort of revealing pieces of information about themselves. You know, oh, well, my younger brother died when I was a kid and I feel guilty, or, you know, something like that. We tend to regard conversational intimacy as a question of, you know, data or content. But in fact, you know, part of what we really enjoy about human relationships isn't necessarily the facts or the information being exchanged, but it's simply the way that people talk, that people have that sort of characteristic style or tone or emotion that sort of colors, you know, they could be talking about the weather or they could be talking about the newspaper. And there's still something sort of characteristically them about the way that they talk about it. And so this for me, I think, has shaped both my strategy in the Turing test, but also the way that I talk to people, you know, over the phone or in my daily life. That I'm maybe less interested in making sure that I give the correct answer in the content sense, and more interested in just sort of trying to talk in a more colorful way or a more sort of distinctive or idiosyncratic way.
Well, one of the interesting things you talk about in the book is how often, you know, when we call a major corporation, a company that we have to deal with, and we get into their switchboard and have to talk to one of the operators, sometimes they don't respond like a real person because they're reading through a script, and it doesn't matter what you say. They're just going to read what the next thing is down on the line, even if it makes no sense. And that's one way in which, you know, it's not a very human way to communicate.
That's right. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, we've all sort of had that experience. And part of what I think is really, in a strange way, quite fascinating about these customer service centers, albeit very frustrating, but what's fascinating to me is that it starts to blur the line, if you will, between a human being and essentially a piece of software. You know, you can think of software as just a very explicit policy of if this happens, then do this. And so when you're talking to someone who's at one of these call centers, you have this very uncanny experience where you're clearly talking to a real human being, but all that they are doing is typing in what you say into a computer and then reading back to you what the computer says. So, in effect, you are talking with a piece of software. It has a legitimate human voice. And these examples for me start to point to the sense in which, you know, being human or acting in a human way is not simply a question of, you know, you are human, so it just automatically happens. But in fact, we are seeing these situations where, you know, effectively you have chatbot software that instead of running on a computer is in fact running on a human mind. And I think that also forms a sort of cautionary tale or an interesting lens for us to sort of think about human interaction.
So you're saying, you know, some of those call operators are as much cyborgs as Deep Blue, the computer that beat Chessmaster Kasparov.
Yeah, that's right. That, you know, if you are in a situation where you're responding to life in a completely procedural way, you know, that the book is sort of already written in terms of if they say X, you say Y. Then essentially you're sort of becoming a little bit of a robot. You know, that part of what makes, you know, a truly great customer service representative is the ability to sort of know when to get off script or when to make exceptions to the rule. And that becomes, I think, this critically valuable piece that we maybe hadn't fully appreciated until we now enter this realm where, you know, the existence of chatbot software that can do this sort of pure policy approach makes us realize that perhaps there is something missing to that approach.
Well, one of the things that you're pretty fluent in is poetry and language. And poetry uses language in a different way than a purely utilitarian way. It makes art with words. How important was that, that sort of poetic sense of language, when you took your Turing test?
Well, in fact, it turned out, I think, to be surprisingly useful. That, you know, in some sense, I have this very eclectic academic background. I have degrees in computer science, philosophy, and poetry. So it was satisfying in the Turing test to have this rare case where I could actually draw on my entire background. But in fact, what I think is so exciting about artificial intelligence is that it's bringing us to this very interesting moment where things that poets are interested in and things that, you know, computer scientists are interested in are starting to overlap. So, for example, one of the big dangers of you know, modern communication is, as we were saying, you know, email spam bots. And so when I send someone a message and I want them to click on a link, say, you know, in the past I might have been able to just to say, hey, I thought you'd find this interesting, check it out. Now, in 2011, that email probably doesn't cut the mustard anymore because it's too generic. It's going to maybe make the person skeptical whether it's really me that sent the link or it's a computer program. And so what I have to do is basically, to some extent, aestheticize my email. Say something that's sort of a joke or sounds like my kind of characteristic way of speaking. And so essentially what I'm doing is what poets are doing, which is this battle against generic language, this drive to kind of forge this idiosyncratic and distinctive voice. That actually now becomes something that can make a computer network more secure. So it's this very strange place where the concerns of IT people and the concerns of creative writers are starting to merge.
Hmm.
And I think there's also, at a more explicit level, one of my competitors, if you will, in the Turing test was a chatbot program called Cleverbot. And the way that Cleverbot works is that it's basically a giant database of previous human conversations. So Cleverbot is a program on a website, and it just sort of hangs out on this website all day long, talking to people. And it's recording everything that people say to it. And so if you start talking, let's say you log on to Cleverbot and start talking about Hawaii, a few days later, if someone asks it questions about Hawaii, it will sort of regurgitate the stuff that you'd said to it a few days before. So Cleverbot is this very strange kind of hall of mirrors where people are effectively talking to past human conversations. I think Cleverbot provides us another example of why something like poetry becomes useful in a Turing test. Because the way to thwart Cleverbot is to say something that is not in its database. So if I ask it, how are you, or where are you from, or what do you do for a living, it has literally thousands of ready-made answers. But if I say something that's more sort of poetic or lyrical or is using language in this very strange, odd way, Cleverbot's really going to be out on its own without anything in its database to sort of help it out. And so that became another example where the more I could try to sort of speak against the grain of, you know, generic language or against the grain of cliche, that was, I felt, part of this anti-computer strategy.
Well, to skip ahead a bit, you flew out to Brighton, England to take part in your Turing test. You were one of the contestants, the human confederates, as you call them. What was that like?
Well, it's a very strange experience to have to persuade someone else that you are a human being. it's a very curious sort of existential position to find yourself in. And there's also sort of this weird pressure where, you know, the conversations are so short. You only have 5 minutes, and you're doing this over sort of internet chat. So 5 minutes goes by really quickly. There's this weird pressure to find some way to kind of really connect with the judge. So, you know, the judge would start a conversation by saying, you know, "Hi, how are you?" I would say, "Oh, I'm good. How are you?" They would say, "Oh, I'm good." And I'd start to get really sort of fidgety and nervous because I knew that this was sort of the generic conversation that the computers were completely ready for. And so part of it for me was this real desire to look for opportunities to kind of get the conversation. I use the phrase out of book, which was as soon as one judge mentioned being from Seattle, I started talking about, you know, alternative rock. As soon as one judge mentioned, you know, buying a new camera, we started talking about photography. So looking for those moments to really wrench the conversation off of that kind of boilerplate chit chat. That became, you know, a big concern.
And you did pretty well for your species, didn't you?
Yeah.
You made us proud.
Yes. I'm very happy to report that not only did my fellow Confederates and I essentially avenge our near defeat of 2008, and in fact, not only did the computers fail to cross that 30% threshold, in fact, in my year, it was a complete shutout. So
wow.
we really came back fighting from the previous year.
That says good things, I guess, about the future of humanity.
Well, it does. You know, I mean, I think one of the characteristic narratives that we tend to have about these kind of man versus machine things is that we see the progress of science as more or less inexorable, you know. And so that puts us in a position where as soon as the machines overtake us once, we don't even have the contest anymore. So after the chess world champion Garry Kasparov lost to the IBM supercomputer Deep Blue, naturally Kasparov wanted a rematch. But the IBM team said, "Well, you know, we've proven that we can beat you. We don't need to play anymore." And they basically sort of dismantled the system. And in the case of the Turing test, the sponsor is a man named Hugh Loebner, and he said, you know, the first year that the computers pass the Turing test, he'll, you know, kind of pull the plug on the funding because the test has kind of done what it, you know, was set out to do. But, in fact, I feel quite strongly that one of the distinctive things about being human is precisely our ability to bounce back from that sort of thing. That, especially because the Turing test is a measure of human conversation skills, I would be quite fascinated, actually, to see what would happen the year that we first lose.
Hmm.
What do we do to kind of pick ourselves off the canvas and really think about how we interact with each other? To my mind, that would be a tremendously exciting opportunity.
Brian Christian is our guest this hour. He's the author of the book we're talking about. It's called The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. And we're hoping to hear from you now. What do you think sets humans apart from computer programs? And what about the way that humans communicate with one another? Are we making sure to invest enough humanity in our everyday interactions with one another? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Summer to-do lists often include home improvement and repair, and damage from extreme weather can move to the top of the list these days. After 11, Judith Sears Poisson talks with construction professionals who can help you decide what to do and when. That's 11 o'clock as Judith is in for Larry Mueller today. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn this hour. We're talking with Brian Christian, who is the author of the book The Most Human Human. He took part in the Turing test, which was a kind of blind chat where a panel of judges, who were, of course, themselves people, were trying to decide whether or not they were chatting with a computer or a person. And as we just found out, Brian did well for his species. He, in fact, he won the Most Human-Human Award, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. This is a very curious award that they have. So I should explain that there are really two awards given out every year at the test. The way that the test is scored is that at the end of each conversation, the judge rates basically how confident they were that they were talking to a real person. And so every year, the computer that gets the highest score wins this prize called the Most Human Computer Prize, and they get sort of a research grant for the programming team. And that's really the award that the test is designed to confer. But they have this other award, which is very bizarre and intriguing, that goes to the human that got the highest score from the judges. And that's called the Most Human Human Award. I'm in fact very proud to be the Most Human Human of 2009.
Congratulations. I suppose it's better than being the least human human.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, let's take our first phone call. We've got Steve joining us from Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yep. Good morning. Without meaning to offend the host, I'm wondering whether the guest has some criteria by which he can determine that this is not a Turing test against the machine.
Hey, now.
So I'm being asked how I know that you, Steve, are a real person and not a computer?
Oh, Steve is gone. Maybe Steve is the computer. No, I think Steve was talking about me.
Oh. Well, you know, I think that one of the themes that comes up in the book is the notion of, we were sort of touching on it a little bit when we were talking about Cleverbot as being this assemblage of previous human conversations. And looking at, you know, Robert Epstein's unfortunate experiences accidentally dating a chatbot for 4 months, that I think what it starts to point to about conversation is that there are a number of examples in human life where we ask questions that the other person is so familiar with that they can just sort of fire off an answer. And so, you know, one of the groups of people that I talked to in my preparation for the test was, in fact, professional interviewers. And so I think that, you know, part of what makes for a good interview is the same thing that makes for a good date or the same thing that makes for a good Turing test, is sort of those moments when you can get the person out of their, you know, routine or out of the things that they're typically used to saying and get them sort of thinking on their feet. And I think that's really a part of human conversation that kind of transcends what mode it's in, that it's really sort of applicable to all those situations.
Are there moments in that conversation you had with your judge where you thought you really did a good job of getting outside the box of what a computer might be able to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to look back and say, oh, you know, I did everything right. But, of course, at the time, I had no idea how it was coming off or, you know, if I was trying too hard to sound human and therefore sort of defeating myself in the process. But, you know, I think that part of my strategy was, you know, as we were saying, to go off of book, to look for those places to kind of get the conversation out of that sort of exchange of formalities. Another part of it was structural, basically. So, you know, another thing that I look at in the book is the nature of turn-taking in conversation. And in particular, this notion of what linguists call barge-in. And the idea of barge-in is any time sort of a strict taking of turns breaks down and people start sort of overlapping or finishing each other's sentences or talking over one another. And this is something that, you know, if you're from a big family or if you get a group of, you know, four old friends together over drinks, you start to notice that the conversation in many cases doesn't really look like a strict taking of turns. It's just sort of one big stream of language that everyone's sort of chipping in. And people are, you know, interrupting each other. People are trying to sort of hold the floor and maintain, you know, a conversational thread and mm-hmm. resist an interruption. That there's an awful lot of dynamism to human conversation just at a structural level. And that's precisely what we don't have to grapple with when we talk to people, for example, over text message or email, because the turn-taking is extremely rigid. And so part of what I wanted to do in the Turing test was to see if I couldn't bring some of that fluidity to bear in this instant message medium. So one of the quirks of the Loebner Prize is that, unlike typical instant messaging, which is transmitted sort of line by line or sentence by sentence, in the Turing test, you can see the other person typing letter by letter, which is sort of an unfamiliar medium to most of us. We're not used to the idea that when we're instant messaging someone, they can see words forming as we type them. But what it does allow for is precisely that kind of barge in and that kind of structural fluidity that oral conversation has. And so, for example, one of the judges started saying, you know, how are you doing today? But he misspelled the word today. So I see him start to backspace, you know, and start to retype the word. And so I found myself, without thinking too hard about it, doing what we would normally do in a spoken conversation if someone's fumbling for a word, but it's obvious what word they're fumbling for, which is I just finished his sentence for him, and then I answered the question myself. I said something like, today? Oh, I'm good, thanks. And looking back, I do think was one of the moments that I can point to and say, you know, I was going above and beyond what AI is currently capable of. Because, you know, it's hard enough, if asked a question and given, you know, the floor, it's hard enough to know what to say or to say the right thing. If you add to that the complexity in live conversation of knowing when to speak and how long to speak and when to interrupt or when to allow yourself to be interrupted, it quickly becomes, you know, overwhelmingly complicated for the computer. So by importing that complexity, I think I was able to try to push the conversation to a place where it really was different.
Right, so real conversations don't sound like you're reading from a screenplay or a play. They kind of, they're misshapen, kind of messy things, and sounds like that's what
right.
you were getting at. Well, let's get some of our callers in. I have Jeff waiting to talk to you from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. I read the piece in The Atlantic on your project, in your book. It was entitled Why Machines Will Never Beat the Human Mind, which sounds like a possibly dangerous boast, almost like one of those that's, you know, 100 years ago, man will never fly or whatever. But in this case, I sort of tend to agree with it. I want to get your comments on this. Just I was thinking about when reading your article, and in that computers are programmed with language, whatever those languages are. And I think what sets us apart, obviously, are emotions and feelings, which emotional memory lies in the parts of the brain that are essentially nonverbal. And so it seems counterintuitive, to me at least, that feelings and emotions could be programmed because we would need language to do that. Therefore, they wouldn't be emotions and feelings. They would be verbal then. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a critically important point. And I think it really relates to, I think, two distinct things. The first is that, you know, part of what it means to be human is to be a human, meaning a specific person with a specific life history, if someone says, I'm not a dog person, maybe that is rooted in some biographical experience where a dog bit them when they were young or something like that. And in fact, you know, one of the distinctive things about people is that because we're the product of this distinct, unique life history, we're all a little bit different. And what we know or don't know or find interesting or find scary it all in some ways ties back to this idiosyncratic biography that we all have. Whereas computers are specifically designed not to have any sort of history. You know, you just, there are these blank slates that, you know, when I go to the computer store to buy a laptop, it doesn't occur to me to think which one I want. You know, the point is that they're all exactly the same. And so there are people that would argue, and I think there's maybe something to be said for it, that in order to get to a point where we've got legitimate AI, we're going to have to make computers that don't do what we expect computers to do, which is this sort of repeatability, this sort of equivalence and interchangeability, which is, in fact, one of their strengths, you know, the way that they're currently built. And the other thing, you know, relating to what you're saying about, you know, perhaps we denigrate emotion because it's nonverbal, I think that's absolutely right. That one of the themes that the book looks at is what aspects of the human experience we've prized over the years, and which we've sort of swept under the rug. And in particular, you know, if you go back through the history of philosophy, this question of what makes humans unique, what makes humans unique and special and different goes all the way back to Descartes, to Aristotle. But, of course, they're not talking about what makes people different from computers. They're talking about what makes people different from animals. And so, you know, the whole history of Western philosophy has this very strange bias where they say, you know, having emotions isn't that impressive. It's not that interesting. It's not that important. It's not that central to the human experience that we have bodies, that we navigate a three-dimensional environment, that we're mortal, that we need to eat, that we form social groups, we recognize faces, we recognize familiar objects. Everything that animals can do was sort of set aside as being kind of base or kind of simple or primitive. And the real emphasis was put on these, you know, quote-unquote left-brain things, like abstract reasoning, algebra, language. And so I do think that it's one of the great ironies that the advent of the computer in the 20th century really, I think, upends basically 2,000 years of philosophy, because what we're seeing is the computer becomes instantly adept at precisely these sorts of hyper-rational left-brain things. You know, it can do math, it can do calculus, it can analyze things logically better than we can. But what it can't do yet, anyway, is, you know, navigate a three-dimensional environment without bumping into things, recognize objects, form relationships, use language in a natural way, and express emotions. And so I think it's really a great validation of precisely these sort of animal qualities as, in fact, being quite central to the human experience. So I think the computer is nicely rebalancing our sense of self after, you know, two millennia at least of biasing ourselves, I think, a little bit too much in favor of these left hemisphere things.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Jeff, and we'll take our second break now as we talk with Brian Christian, who is the author of The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. And he also holds a degree in poetry, philosophy, and computer science. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have an open phone line for you as we talk about what makes humans human. That's the subject of our guest book. Brian Christian is the author. He wrote the book, The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. And we're wondering what you think. What sets humans apart from computers? And what strikes you in the way that computers interact with people and the way that human beings interact with one another? And what do you think for the future of a sentient artificial intelligence? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And we have Boyd joining us next. Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Veronica, and good morning, Brian. Just a couple things before I get to the main reason I called. A couple phone calls ago, there was a caller that came on and had said, now, how do you know that, you know, you're not talking to a machine or what have you, or a person? How I personally know how I'm talking with you, Veronica, and with your guests, and why I don't think your machines are, is I think of the Chinese room, where I think where an individual asks someone questions and what have you, but, you know, the person doesn't understand Chinese, but responds, answers questions effectively. Yeah, the guest is probably very familiar with that argument. But the reason I called was what really, in terms of language, has a distinction with humans and computers is computers understand syntax, which I'm sure your guest is getting at. I don't want to go over a lot of people's heads, but syntax is mathematically based and is used in symbolic logic. And actually, computers are superior to humans and when it comes to solving math and what have you. But what separates makes humans, I think, very human is semantic thought. And that is feeling pain, feeling grief, feeling sexually attracted toward another individual. And I think if computers obtain semantics, I think it would be much more of a threat because personally, they would also know what fear is. They would feel threatened. And in order to protect their self-interest, would probably take over. And I know it sounds like something out of the world of science fiction, but I believe that if that would happen, it would really upset the balance of power. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Interesting. Thanks. Interesting thoughts. I mean, thanks, Boyd. And what do you think, Brian?
I think Boyd, you raise an important distinction, the syntax and semantics distinction. And I think one of the things that has been really interesting for me as I've learned more about computational linguistics is that there are a number of really interesting and, at least to my mind, pretty exciting examples that really blur the line between the two. So, for example, diagramming a sentence is the kind of thing that most seventh graders find so boring that, you know, it's just painful to do in class. And so, in fact, it's surprising that we still don't have computer systems that are fully competent at diagramming a sentence and figuring out which words are which parts of speech. And part, as it turns out, of what's so tricky about this is that there are certain questions that, on the face of it, would seem purely grammatical, but in fact involve actual knowledge of how the world works. So, for example, if I say, take the pie out of the oven and close it, the "it" of course means the oven, but if I say take the pie out of the oven and eat it, the "it" of course means the pie. And even though those two sentences are structurally identical, we have no problem realizing that the pronoun is being used in a different way. But that knowledge is world knowledge. We live in a world where we understand that you don't eat ovens and you don't close pies.
And it's hard to reduce language to math.
Well, that's right. That's right. That you find that these seemingly very simple and straightforward problems of, like, tell me what these pronouns point to in the sentence, are in fact not even necessarily mathematical problems, but they invoke a real nuanced sense of how the world works. And there are even worse examples, you know, worse meaning more sort of convoluted and gnarly than the pie thing. So if I say, I separated the egg white from the egg yolk and I ate it with my milkshake, the "it," you have to decide whether it's the white of the egg or the yolk. And so now what on the face of it seems like pure grammar, you actually have to sort of assess my personality. Like, do I seem like the kind of person who wants to bulk up or like the person who wants to reduce cholesterol? So now you have to basically make a judgment about my personality in order to parse the sentence grammatically. So one of the things that sort of delights me as someone who's interested in both computers and language is that it turns out that language is just so bogglingly complicated, more so than we would have thought, even just grammar.
What about being in a really bad mood, being someone who is, could you have gotten on with your judges and just been a total crank and a pain in the butt, and that would have been enough?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, one of the earliest winners of the Most Human Human Award was a Wired columnist named Charles Platt. And when asked, how did you do it? How did you set yourself apart from the computers? He said, I was moody, obnoxious, and irritable. And, I thought, well, gosh, if that's the essence of humanity, that's a bleak statement. But I do think that it gets to this deeper point that, we don't necessarily lead these lives of just simply performing tasks, but we have attitudes about everything that we're doing. And that's something that computers really don't. They follow orders, but they don't do it begrudgingly, or they don't do it eagerly.
They can't cop an attitude yet.
Right.
Let's take another phone call. Gail is with us from Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Interesting program. I'm calling in watching the computer age take off since the early 80s and watching the change in how people in corporations are expected to do their jobs, and there's less and less human contact one-on-one. There's a lot that's being lost, and in the way of how humans actually are able to express themselves just in a natural way because of the restrictions computers are creating for the world, and especially in big business. And I was wondering if your guest was familiar with the author. He's an amazing attorney, Jerry Spence, who wrote a book about slavery in America, and it had to do with the new mindsets of the corporate world and how the whole process of what's expected out of humans in the way of challenging them more to be more less emotional, less interactive, less human, and fill their little spaces of their jobs in a box and not have any other free-flowing input. That kind of starts to go at reducing their ability to actually have soul life in their waking hours. And doing the work that I do, getting involved with people with their consciousness, I see a difference in people in the world as the level of their consciousness, which I don't think computers will ever be able to have, because consciousness tells us what level a soul is at, and computers will never have a soul. So there is going to be a big difference, and computers will, I don't believe, it will ever be able to be taking over what humans can do, because they won't have a soul, and when the power goes out, their computers won't be able to operate. So I just wanted to share, what I've seen and experienced, and what I have read, and if the author was familiar with the books by Jerry Spence. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thanks so much, Gail. And Brian?
Thanks, Gail. No, I'm not familiar with that book, but it sounds like he's sort of speaking to some of these similar questions. I mean, I do think that there is a very real danger of being, whether it's in the business environment or simply living in this social world where we spend so much time on email, on Facebook, text messaging, that there are sort of, not to be conspiratorial about it, but there are these sort of forces at work that tend to make us, I think, in some sense, less human, that for some reason we're now spending so much time communicating in these mediums that are so impoverished compared to speaking on the phone or even, of course, speaking in real life, that we've kind of voluntarily given up so much of the contextual richness and the tonal richness. And, you know, one example that I often like to point to, because I think people are less aware of it.
And we've got about 30 seconds left, just to warn you.
Okay, sorry. Just the move from landlines to cell phones, that we now can reach people so much more easily, but the lag on a cell phone is 5 times as great. And so we start to lose some of that turn-taking richness that we get when we sit down across the table from someone.
Right.
So technology makes us aware of these things.
Well, it's been a great conversation and a fascinating book, too. Brian, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Brian Christian was our guest this hour, the author of The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for taking your phone calls and producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease as well for production help this week. I'm Veronica Rickert, and Kathleen Dunn will be back with you beginning next Monday morning for All Things Political at 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's more to come.